This is Japan Baseball Weekly, the only English podcast covering all 12 NPB teams. And now, your hosts, John E. Gibson and Jim Allen.
Hi, and welcome to the Japan Baseball Weekly podcast. It's for the week of April 12th. I'm John Gibson, and with me late on a Sunday night, but not too late, is Jim Allen. How you doing, bud?
Not too late, man. Where's Wilson, Wicked Wilson Pickett to sing in the midnight hour? And we say, go home, dude. You're early.
Yeah. You're a little bit early, Holmes.
Absolutely. We're not even thinking about the midnight hour. And how nice is that?
well, settle down. Some of us are thinking about the midnight hour, but not as much as others, I suppose. All right, people, keep your masks on. Think of yourself, but think of other people as well. Think of yourself as a healthy spreader. That's the mindset. So keep your masks on. We got numbers going up, down, up, down. It's like, it's crazy here with the COVID in all parts of the country. And we got the Olympics coming, right? Right, Jim?
Perhaps, possibly.
I'm only laughing because it's funny. Again, please go to iTunes and rate, review, and follow us so we can get more pod cred among our fellow podcasters. All right, on this week's show, we've got a chat with former Swallows and Marines outfielder Josh Whitesell. We're going to look at some of the games and teams and handle some high heat. So let's start swinging.
Clearing the bases.
All right, so in this another year of telephone or Zoom interview world known as COVID, we've decided it's always going to be better to have a guest on the show and to bring you guys a different voice. So on the weeks that we don't have or we're not able to get a current player, we'll have someone else. And this week it's Josh Whitesell. And, I want to crack the code to get through to the Giants and Tigers and Swallows and a couple other teams that haven't really cooperated with us so far. We're working on it. We will continue to bring you figures from the past or from the sidelines or from the current days as we go through this season. We will do our best. And with that as the backdrop, I reached out to Josh last week and he said, sure, I can talk. Now he's working for Johnson & Johnson. So it figures he would be busy when I talk to him, and he has twins as well. He has a set of one boy and one girl twins, and just like the Wonder Twins here, he's got his own set of Wonder Twins. So he's busy at night, so we had to do this in the daytime. He's living in California, in Northern California. I think he said Mountain View. Mm-hmm. You know where that is, right?
I do know where that is.
Yeah, I think I've heard of it too, so I think I might have been through it. So
it's Silicon Valley area.
To be precise, I'm pretty sure I've been through it then. And Josh played for the Yakult Swallows 2010 and 2011, then with the Marines 2012 and 2013. And we talked to him. I think he was on the show a couple times, once as a Swallow and once as a Marine for JBW back in the day. So if you guys want to go back through the into the season one or season two and season three of JBW, you can find a couple Josh Whitesell interviews from those days. And he's doing great. He said he's coaching his son in baseball, and he thinks it's going to be soon time to turn it over to another coach because because his blood pressure is rising. And I know, and we talked about this too, he and I, before we started recording, and I talked about how these coaches who coach in youth sports, they're really some of the heroes of worldwide, but for certain of the United States, they're some of the heroes in our country because it's difficult working with the kids and trying to teach them and having to handle the dynamics with the parents and then play against other teams and other parents. And it's a mess. So I always see these guys as the heroes, but he said he's probably going to turn that over to some of the other coaches and watch from the sidelines. But anyway, we were glad to have him on the show. So here's Josh Whitesell. All right, we are glad to be joined by former Swallows and Marines infielder / outfielder Josh Whitesell. How's it going, buddy?
It's doing great. It's a pleasure to be here.
Great to talk to you. You know, something when I was doing a little bit, just a tiny bit of research when I was going to talk to you, I realized that I know you were born
in the in the South, in North Carolina, but that you went to high school in Rialto, which is where I used to live in the 70s when my dad got transferred to Norton Air Force Base, which was no longer around, I think, when you moved out there in Rialto, and that you went to Rialto High School, which wasn't around when I was there. I didn't go to Eisenhower, but I went to Kolb Junior High School, if you know where that is.
It was just Eisenhower and Rialto when I was there, and I think there's now a third high school, Carter High School, is there now. But yeah, my mother was a math teacher at Rialto, and I grew up in Redlands, but then the baseball coach at Rialto had run a much better program than the Redlands coach, so that combined with the fact that I had the easy transportation of my mother already working there. I did have to get to school a little bit earlier than I would have preferred, but it made sense for me to make that trip.
And you did really well in school. I know you got really good grades, and so it all worked out. So now let's get to it. What's the first thing that pops into your head when I say Japanese baseball?
Oh, just fundamentally sound. You know, the dedication to the craft and the way that they work their tails off every day, and the routine plays and the fundamentals that they just have, the solid fundamentals, how everything is just very crisp and played the game at a very high level.
Now, you played for two teams, the Swallows and the Marines. Which do you feel more of a connection to when you think about your playing days here?
I'd say it's pretty split. You know, I have very fond memories of both teams. You know, the Swallows brought me over and gave me an opportunity, and then, you know, the Marines were able to give me a second opportunity, which I was super grateful for. And I don't overwhelmingly connect to one or the other, but just have very fond memories of both.
What about as far as ballparks go? Which ballpark was your favorite? I mean, of all the parks that you played in Japan.
Oh, I think Jingu might be. Well, each one has a little bit of a different flavor, right? So, in every park, you know, you have a little bit different memories of. But I would say overall, Jingu was my favorite, with the open air and the turf and just its proximity to downtown Tokyo. It was everything about Jingu was pretty special, and it's a good hitter's park, which, since I'm a hitter, makes it a little bit better.
Yeah, that figures. So I've had this conversation before, but what kind of roster would you try to build for the Swallows if you were running that team?
I mean, just kind of your prototypical, where you know you're going to want speed at the top of the lineup, and I think you're going to want some power in the middle, because it is a good hitter's park. So you're going to need some batters that can put the ball out of the yard. From the pitching standpoint, I think definitely with that consideration of the, just in general, the Central League being a little bit more of a hitter's park league, that you're going to want swings and misses more. So you're going to want, you know, more of the strikeout type pitchers. Whereas, you know, if you're the Tigers general manager, you know, playing in the dirt at Cochin, you know, getting a sinker baller or somebody that's going to induce a lot more ground balls might be a little bit more up the alley of what you're going after.
Right. Right. All right. Well, can you imagine playing in NPB now during these tough times that we're going through?
Oh, man, no. I mean, it's hard enough just getting through, you know, day to day of getting my boy out the Little League and making sure we're playing here. I know that the challenges being presented to MLB and the NPB and all the kind of professional sports league is... It's pretty insane the times we're going through right now. So I'm happy to not have to deal with the shenanigans of that right now.
Yeah, so what was your biggest challenge in playing in Japan, making that whole transition?
It's just the time away from family. You know, I had boy-girl twins that were born in 2009, and being away from my wife and the twins, and then it was challenging also when they'd come out, because we had a short window, so it was you know, the attention you're trying to obviously commit your entire mind to your craft and do well, you know, as not only for your team but for yourself and be the best player you can, but then you're also trying to be the best father and best husband and trying to split all those duties was probably the most challenging part of playing.
Yeah, I often talk about the off-field issues for players and that the whole thing, you know, the whole thing is connected. So it's hard for, I think, fans to understand that part. So I'm glad you said that. Now, there's talk in the major leagues of the ball being different this year. Now, you played here in 2011 when the great ball scandal, part one, I think, took place. What's it like as a player when there's a change to the equipment like that, especially without your knowledge?
Well, it was super frustrating in 2011. I came over in 2010 and I had a lot of success. And then in 2011, not only did they change the ball, but if you recall, after the tsunami and the earthquake and, you know, the madness from that,
correct,
we were operating at 60% lighting, or maybe even less. Mm. I don't even know if that number is completely correct, but we were using somewhere in the neighborhood of 40 to 60% of the lights. And I'm trying to hit a round ball with seams coming at me. And one of the biggest things, you know, that I did well was I had a good eye. And I needed to judge what was a strike and what was a ball as quickly as possible. And I felt very just, I guess, not comfortable in the box as far as my vision was concerned.
Sure.
And seeing the spin on the ball. So not only was the ball not flying like it was the previous year, but I was also having to deal with more or less hitting in the dark, and it's probably, looking back at the entirety of my baseball career, that those couple months in 2011 were the most challenging mentally based on those two things.
Yeah, I remember specifically asking you kind of early on in the season that year in 2011 about the ball, and it seemed to me that you wanted to remain neutral on the record. But what were you saying at the time when the press was not around? What were you guys really saying?
Oh, just there was definitely a difference. And I mean, you're looking at guys that had hit, you know, like Craig Brazell and Marichan, Alex Ramirez hitting, you know, 40, 50 home runs the year before, and now those numbers are being, you know, more or less cut in half.
Yeah.
And this had nothing to do with their abilities to hit the baseball, and had everything to do with the change in the ball that had occurred. So it was just frustrating because baseball is a game of consistency. You do this, you know, you practice a lot of the same things, and you work on a lot of the same things, and when something's thrown off, it can be very frustrating and take more time than you'd like to be able to adjust back to.
Yeah, so basically you guys were telling us, because I remember, I actually think we did a podcast interview, and you said, the words I remember, we don't have enough data, I'm not ready to say that the ball is different, but it sounds like you guys really knew that something was going on.
Yeah. I mean, you don't ever want to use anything as an excuse, right? So you know, at the end of the day, like, everybody had to play with the same ball. So it doesn't affect the outcome of one particular match.
Sure.
It just presents challenges on how, you know, baseball is a very mentally challenging game, and it just presents more mental challenges, basically.
Right. I asked this question of Alex Ramirez a long time ago, but how much of hitting is mental in your mind? What percentage, and how much is physical?
I mean, it's probably somewhere. It's hard to put a number out of 50-50, call it, because obviously you have to have the physical tools, like, and you have to be strong enough to swing the bat. You have to have, you know, at least reasonably good swing mechanics to be able to hit the ball. But I will say that a confident, like the mental aspect of being confident and believing in yourself and going out there every day with a positive attitude and knowing that you can get the job done, and the mental aspect of dealing with failure, because baseball is a game of failure, that is also just as or probably more important. And we all have known guys that really don't have very good swings from a technical standpoint, mm-hmm. but maybe they just smash because their mental game is so strong and they believe in themselves.
Yeah, it's a good point. It's a great point. All right, last question. Why do you think it's so difficult for the smaller market teams to win in Japan, even though effectively they can spend as much money as they want on players and do basically what they want, but the small market teams seem to struggle here?
That's a good question. The reason they don't sign their big ticket free agents back is they just don't want to spend the money, or maybe they're just more believe in their developmental farm system, and that they can, if they do a good job with developing and drafting, that they'll be able to field a competitive team that way. I mean, I know, didn't Hiroshima just win like a couple years ago, right? Or
yeah, it did. Yes.
Followed completely the NPB results recently, so I don't have a good baseline on exactly what the records were for those teams. But I just think the most important thing is being able to have a good system where you can develop players and players feel comfortable enough to be able to fail at times, and then know that, you know, if they bust their tail and they continue to improve, and then they'll be given a chance to succeed in the future.
All right, buddy. Well, hopefully we can talk to you again sometime in the future. We really appreciate your time today. I know you're busy. We can hear you working in the background. So thank you very much for the chat, and we will talk to you again.
Yes, sir. Thank you very much, John.
All right. Best of luck to you.
All right. You too.
All right, Jim. what stood out for you after hearing good old Josh talk about the baseball and the lighting and other things?
Okay. Well, yeah, the lighting and particular, I was really happy to hear about, because very few people talk about it. And it'll bring back a few things. I did wanted to bring up some notes, because I remember the reduced lighting that was in effect, I think, until the end of June for all the teams for the Eagles and all the other teams in the Tokyo area.
Right.
So they all had that trouble. And I think actually in the beginning, they weren't allowed to play night games.
That's correct. I remember that as well.
And the Giants did what the Giants would do, is they said, well, you're not going to tell us what we're going to do. We're going to go play night games somewhere else. So they didn't play their home games at Tokyo Dome for a while. So it was a mess, that whole thing. But anyway, rather than comment any more or put it in a better light than he did, which I can't really do, I'm just going to give the listeners a couple of notes for reference.
Okay.
Okay. The uniform baseball was introduced with great fanfare in 2011. It wasn't like a secret. No, everybody knew it was coming. They saw it in spring training. They heard about it. They knew about it. Nobody quite knew how dead it was going to be, because, you know, they said it's going to be deader. And there were issues with it, but it wasn't in any case a secret or anything. People weren't really happy with it. None of the teams ever liked it. And it was changed. 2013 was the year it was changed without anybody talking about it. It was changed in secret.
Right. And you're referencing my question to him talking about 2011. And so, yeah, I got those dates years. Out of order. Yeah. That's on me.
So 2013. So 2013 was the year it was changed, and I got lots of opinions about that, which nobody really wants to hear right now.
Well, I was under the assumption everybody said that, you know, the ball was deadened, and we talked about other things, so we just didn't know how much it was going to
correct
change, so
or how it was going to affect people's, you know,
livelihoods.
Yeah. Right. I remember that season because I think I was, you know, tracking to some degree. I'm not Patrick Newman or anything, but I was tracking where balls were going out of the park, and I think the first. I don't think there were any balls hit to the any home runs hit to the opposite field.
Oh yeah, well, I think we did talk about that on the show that year.
Right.
And
until Yoshinobu Takahashi hit a couple out right after the All-Star break.
Mm-hmm. And
or maybe it was Hisayoshi Chono. I don't remember. It was one of those two guys.
One of the Giants players. But I think what probably got me off track was I just remember 2011 as the year that we had both the hitters and the pitchers complaining, because I remember, I think it was Brian Bullington. I think he said he threw a ball one time that someone hit to the outfield, and when he got it back, it was the shape had changed, and so the ball was deformed. And so that was the year, that's why it sticks out in my head, because that's the year we have both hitters and pitchers complaining about the ball, which you rarely have.
Yeah, pretty much. Yeah, that was the, Termal Sledge. I remember Termal Sledge was with the DeNA Bay, with the Yokohama Bay Stars then, and he was going, look, you hit the ball and you do leave a dent. It's like hitting a beanbag. So... Mm-hmm. And what I noticed was the guys were trying to really hit it hard. I mean, everybody was over swinging to try to drive the ball, and it just didn't really work. So, and the remarkable thing about that season was Taki and Nakamura having a career year. In the year, nobody else could hit home runs.
I think Okawari. Yeah.
He's
smacking.
That was a historic season for his home runs. I mean, not in the sheer number, but the fact that he hit them like nobody told him the ball was different. Okay, so there was that. And then in 2014, the other one, which John and I talked about after this interview, was that 2014, suddenly the balls started jumping again, even more. So 2013, they became lively when they made a livelier ball and didn't tell anybody. And then 2014, suddenly the ball is livelier still.
Mm-hmm.
And in April, people said, hey, what's going on? You know, it didn't take them until May to figure it out. And Mizuno, the sporting goods manufacturer that now makes all of NPB's balls, blamed it on 2,300 boxes with 12 balls each being improperly stored in China.
Right.
Yeah. Right. And this is
dry, too dry.
Exactly. And the thing about that got to me was essentially Mizuno got the contract. Ostensibly, they got the contract to produce NPB's baseballs because of their ability to control the quality.
Ding, 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 ding.
Exactly. I mean, it was so much like the 2019 winter meetings when MLB Commissioner Rob Manfred's there at a press conference and he's talking about the baseball, because everybody was talking about the baseball and, you know, it was to this and it was to that and it was jumping and why, and we didn't do anything, but it's flying. And he said, basically, my friend Meredith Wills asked, well, I think it was Meredith who asked, said, look, you bought the company that manufactures the baseballs in order to assure quality control. And now you're telling us that you have no control over the quality.
Lack of institutional control, baby.
Yeah. So she says, so which is it? And he went, well, nobody can exactly produce the baseball. It's like, you know, whatever. So anyway, so that was the Japan case of, well, we're good at it, but we're not as good as we, you know, nobody's good at it. We're better at it, but nobody's perfect.
Right.
Okay.
You got to have one comment about something Josh said.
Well, I thought the comments about his, as I said, I completely agree with his comments about the light. I mean, I think that was huge. There were lots of things going on besides the ball. in 2011, and one of them being the light. And it was really not a surprise that the hitting ticked up quite a bit after the lights came on. The lights went back to full strength. There was another one, actually, I would like to ask people about, but I don't. Everybody gives me one of those, well, who knows answers, is 2011 was also the year that they merged the umpiring crews from the two leagues.
Oh, that's right. Yeah. Yeah. The Central League and the Pacific League umpires started to mix and match.
Yeah. So the crews were all mixed up. And what my impression was that basically the Pacific League strike zone, which had been different, just disappeared. The Central League umpires basically took over.
They said, "You're doing it wrong."
Exactly.
Do it like this. Yeah, yeah. But it was a good change. I liked the whole.
I didn't mind it, but I think it was difficult for a lot of people because.
Well, if you're going to play interleague, yeah, I think if you're going to have interleague, then you can't have such a variance in strike zones that the guys can't really compete because they're taking pitches that they're used to taking as balls or strikes.
Well, there was no interleague was a kind of a haphazard thing.
I mean,
haphazard is in it wasn't thought out in advance very far. It was decided on in September 2004, and it was instituted in May 2005.
Right.
So, you know,
well, we'll talk about that another day. Maybe somebody will ask a question.
And then they went with two different leagues umpires. They went under the same control in 2010, and they merged the crews in 2011. So, anyway.
Yeah, well, I was happy with it.
So, what would you like to comment on, other than Little League and kids and stuff?
It is about the kids. I just thought it was profound that JW really he pointed to being away from his family as the biggest adjustment to playing in MPB because we often hear. I went through and counted all the episodes, so this is actually our episode number 420, which means we've probably done interviews with let's just call it around 350 at least, because we've had maybe we've had a lot of repeat guests, so let's just say around 350. And a lot of the players and coaches and people involved with Japanese baseball have always talked about, oh, you know, it's tough, they pitch backwards here, it's difficult to get the timing, the pitchers have such great control, they have funky motions. This isn't the approach to baseball that I'm used to. The coaching, we've always heard all these things, the food, the travel, and JW, he pointed to the family. And because I remember he had, you know, that first year he was really successful and seemed like he was going to stay a long time and he was going to play for the Swallows a long time. And then things changed and he ended up with the Marines. And then I remember he had incidents where he has follow through hit catchers. He conked catchers on the head.
That was him.
Somehow he wasn't in the lineup, and then he was gone, and now he's back in the States. So I know it's different for each player, but for me, this kind of reinforces the statements I made earlier this season when we had some comments and talked about these things, that the family part of it is so important, and that it's so such a large part of who the man is. And we try to separate and just look at the player, but you really can't in some cases. So I thought that was interesting. And I did like him talking about the pitching, that the pitchers have just such good control here generally in Japan. And he says that, and yet, you know, you see some guys, I saw a lot of it today, just constantly missing spots and missing location this way and that way and the other way, but still not missing in dangerous areas a lot of times. You know, they might miss. Shintaro Fujinami, one prime example number one, but they might miss a lot of times, but they don't miss in bad areas of the plate. And sometimes even when they do, you know, you don't always get punished. I always like the TV announcer who says, "Well, the pitcher made one mistake tonight, and somebody hit it out." I'm like, "No, nobody just makes one little mistake. They made a few other mistakes. It's just that they didn't get hit. So why are you looking at the result and calling that the mistake instead of looking at the other mistakes that they made. Because they don't see them, that's why.
Yeah. Well, they don't see them, and it makes for bad TV if you have to point out every mistake. I mean, it's okay.
Bad TV.
It does. I mean, that's what it's all about. It's like the story when you're writing a story about a game. You know, how many thousands of Japanese game stories have you read when, you know, so-and-so grounded the ball to second and the run scored, you know, and he was the hero because he made an out.
I know that's just, that's your thing that you hang on. And I always say, it's important because if he doesn't get it done, especially in a game like baseball, then it's not like you have a fourth quarter where you can do something else, you know, and the person has to get the run home. But I know it's important. I'm not saying it's more important than the other things, but
no.
I do don't mind them pointing out the guy who made the play, but it is random. You know, sometimes in basketball, you can give the ball to your best player. In football, you can give the ball to your best player. In baseball, somebody just happens to be up that time.
Yeah. But what I love is the quotes, you know, the quotes, because they will print a quote that says, you know, the pitcher was doing so well and I wanted, you know, we wanted to get him some runs, so I was trying really hard, which of course I'm sure he was, and I'm sure the other guys were trying really hard to greater or lesser degree, but it always sounds like he was the one who was trying.
Or that he was trying this time, but all the other times, you know, that wasn't really me.
No, that's the Makoto Kaneko school of hitting.
All right. Well, we appreciate Josh taking the time, and thanks a lot, buddy, and hope you can tune in and at least check out this episode. I know he's busy. Let's make a four-seam transition and talk about the fact that we've gone through one round of a complete round of games against everyone has played everyone now in both leagues. And so my overall impression is that the Pacific League is even tighter than I think I expected it to be. These teams are really close. I said it in the prediction show. I said I expect the top three to kind of pull away, but after that I thought maybe there'd be some separation. But you know, if Oryx is going to win five games and Lotte has five wins, and then the next three the top three teams are, you know, two of them have eight wins and Rakuten has nine wins to sit atop the Pacific League at the moment, I think that's kind of a tight start. Usually there's a little bit more separation. And of course the Fighters, I thought they had a really bad start, and that the only reason nobody was talking about it was because the Bay Stars had this awful start where they couldn't win a game at all. But in the meantime, once they won a game, they had tied the Fighters in wins. And nobody was really talking about it. They were all focused on the fact that the Fighters weren't scoring runs and hadn't hit a home run for a while. But I guess I'm really impressed with the Lions. That's the surprise team early on for me. And this rookie, Gakuto Wakabayashi, a pick in the fourth round for them in the draft last year, he got hit by a pitch and he went out of the game on Saturday. But I think he's a real good find, a nugget for them. And you know, he's small in stature. Probably he's got a little bit of speed, but he had hit with a little bit of power. And I don't know how long he's going to be out. I know he got hit in the foot with a pitch.
Yeah, well, with the Lions, I don't not know his status, but I think with the Lions, you're sort of they've got tickets, and when you get to the active roster, they give you a ticket. When your number comes up, you just get hurt and go get deactivated because they're just running through the roster. I mean, it's like
they're like going.
You know, I'd be surprised if some of the coaches don't say, "Are you on our team?"
Are you on a team? How'd you get in here? How'd you get this number?
Yeah, we're you know, it's like this week we had Ito Takeda.
Takeda, yeah.
Now he was a player to be named later in sort of a different way.
Right,
he his career
missing his last name.
That's right.
He still is a player to be named later.
That's correct. He started his pro career as Ito Otaki, and then I assume he got married. And then he got married, and he was adopted into his wife's family. This is common practice in Japan when you marry into a family with no sons.
I wouldn't say a common practice, but it does happen.
It happens. And you'll see.
Yeah, I wouldn't say common. I mean, common makes it sound like it's happening, you know, like you know people. I've never met anybody who has changed his name. Yeah.
Oh. I can think of a half dozen baseball players who've done it, so it doesn't seem, it's not that surprising to me. And so he is known as Ito. When he turned pro, his name was Ito Otake, and now his name is Ito Takeda, but everybody knows him as Ito. Okay, so he comes up, and he's not old, but he's spent basically 6 years on the Lions farm team, and he comes up, and he's like, he'd been a reserve. He'd had about 40 or 50 at bats on the first team, and first came back, and bam, home run. And then, oh wait, I like that one so much. He hit a solo home run. That was the first of his career. And then
this is on Friday. Yes.
Yeah, on Friday. And then I think it was the seventh inning. He hit a two run or a three run homer. And that was his second. And
opposite
the next
field.
Day, and then the next day he hits his third. So it's like, oh. You know, oh, that's how you do it. Oh, okay.
Yeah, I thought, okay, well, they're really digging down in the deep in the barrel here.
Yeah.
And he had done nothing, and I had seen a few of his swings at the top level here,
mm-hmm.
and he had done nothing to this point to make any of us believe he was first team material. And I think the same goes with Wu Nianting. Is that how you said it last week? And both of these guys. They just took 1 week each to have some success and have a breakout performance. But still, and even Kento Watanabe, the heavy hitting rookie, mm-hmm. looks like Takeya Nakamura. Or
they got the Lions got a thing for the big guys.
Yeah, they just step up and step up, and they've been filling all the holes. And they're 8-5, and they're looking, you know, they're looking pretty strong. And I thought that this was the kind of pitching they might get. And I think when healthy Zach Neale, who's ready to go, who said he's back, and I think he has less than a week now of isolation before he can rejoin the team. I think when they get him back, he can change the dynamics in their rotation. I like the way they look, but I just do not see this as a sustainable plan for the Lions to have all their best players injured and have unproven players come up and produce.
I'll tell you a funny thing is I hadn't seen the games when Wu was playing, but when I did, I went, somebody like switched his body from the kid out of the rookie, the little skinny rookie. He put some muscle on.
Yeah.
I mean,
it wasn't like you could roll him out there before.
No, but he's built himself up a bit. So that's always it's hard to do with some of these Japanese teams, because I've complained about pretty much on a daily basis. And the Lions are one of them. They don't. If the guys don't want to lift and don't want to learn how to get stronger, they ain't gonna tell you.
Yeah. I remember Tyrone Woods always said he was always in the weight room alone.
That's right.
Let's talk about the Hawks a little bit. I thought last week I was going to make the comment that they were playing with their food a little bit. They were, you know, it's really difficult. You win all these championships and you're always around on the verge of a pennant or close to winning a pennant every year, that it makes regular season games have a practice game feel. And so I thought they were playing with their food and why should we worry about it? And aren't they just juggling and playing a little bit of Yahtzee to see who they can trust when the games get serious? And they're trying things out and they're trying to stay competitive within the team so that they can keep that competitive fire and spirit burning and all the players and blah, blah, blah. I mean, they got 140 games they got to burn before they start playing actual baseball. So they experienced, I guess, ace Kodai Senga finally made his debut on Tuesday and then had this play, had a comebacker and twisted his body and wrenched his ankle. And he's in more than an ankle. He damaged a tendon. And so he's going to be out for a lengthy period,
ligament.
Maybe 2 to 3 months. Ligament, not a tendon.
Yep.
So he's going to be out a lengthy period, 2 to 3 months. And I had a high ankle sprain a long time ago. I don't think I damaged any tendons or ligaments. I'm sorry, any ligaments in it. But I taped it up and I kept playing for about 2 months to for me before it was like I didn't feel it anymore, but I kept taping my ankle anyway. And I didn't have that game where I needed to use my ankle so much. I was more of a like a power forward, you know, 6 foot long armed power forward who used his backside and and could rebound. But so I didn't really run around and use my ankle all the time, make cuts all over the place. But it's just too bad for Senga. I was happy to see him come back and anxious to see him do well. But I don't really think it impacts the Hawks that much. It seems like they can get just as good a start or as bad a start from any guy who steps on the mound any day. You know, he's capable of pitching 7-8 innings of shutout ball or throwing 2 or 3 bad innings and have them fall behind by 7 runs early in the game. I think it could happen any day.
Yeah, maybe, but they're not in tune. Maybe it's because they're too busy playing with their food to be in tune. And when I've seen, you know, a couple of games from Tsuyoshi Wada where he walked a bunch of guys, and I'm going, that's really not the plan. And almost when I see Shuta Ishikawa pitch, some days I see him, which is the guy who the ball moves so much that he can't throw it, keep it in the strike zone.
Mm-hmm.
The typical game for him is like, let's say he throws 6 innings. It's, you know, 3 hits, 7 strikeouts, and 4 walks. You know, he doesn't give up hits, or 2 hits and 5 walks. You know, that's, and 9 strikeouts. That's his kind of game. And I've seen games where it's almost like the coaches are telling him, we'll give you a puppy if you don't walk a batter. And he's out there like Lenny in Grapes of Wrath, you know. Can I have a puppy, yeah. George?
he pitched well the other day, but even, you know, late in the game, I think he ended up giving some runs. But look, their starters are not winning or losing a lot of the games. They're still close. It's the relievers who seem to be winning and losing the games or barely holding on. Wow. And Levon Moinello came back, and it I just love watching that guy pitch, because it just seems like even if somebody gets a hit off of him, it's totally an accident. And he just seems to me like he's never going to give up a run, or even if he gives up a hit or walks a guy, you're just not going to score. Wow.
No, I was going to say, you have to go back in your database to find out the last time he got a hit, gave up a hit, because it wasn't this year.
Oh, well, he hadn't really pitched that much.
That's this year. True.
He came in, he's in such control of everything, and he's basically a breaking ball pitcher who, you know, sneak that fastball right past you because you can pinpoint it. He's so much like a Japanese pitcher to me. He's like, he doesn't have the slider the same way, but he seems to me like Hitoki Iwase.
Hmm.
That's what I think of when I think of it. Just, you know, you're going to get a hit, but it's going to be when he makes a mistake, and he doesn't make many. So, and then the Marines for me, I think the engine is kind of on. It's still in low gear, and the Marines had that stretch where they couldn't win and they looked bad coming out of the gate, but they got to play the Fighters early in the week. And I thought that was a good break for them. And got them. It was going to get them going, but and the Fighters, to me, they just seem mixed up, just confusing. Like there's a lot of players, a lot of lineups, a lot of mixing, a lot of matching, and they had this issue where they didn't have any home runs. So it was Taishi Ota on Wednesday finally clubbed the team's first home run of the season, but they lost 6-2 at home against SoftBank, and that was game number 10. Before they had a home run. So, and I was also looking at their early run differential, which neared minus 40 on Thursday, but it's only minus 35 after today. So that team is having its troubles.
Yeah, they had, there was a really weird thing, because Hideki Kuriyama, the manager, had this thing on Wednesday or Thursday. I guess it was Wednesday. When Shonakata did a Cecil Fielder. Now, I don't mean he went back to the States and hit a bunch of home runs for the New York Yankees. I mean, he got annoyed And I think he threw his bat in the dugout. And it came back and popped him in the eye.
I did not see that.
Or he broke his bat or something. Well, anyway, so he apparently broke his bat and he fell in the dugout or behind the dugout. You know, it was a little vague to me. And his eye was all swollen up and he couldn't play the following day. And Kuriyama got a little testy when reporters asked him about Nakata's eye. And he was like, "Don't ask me, ask him, like, get out of my face." Which is so unlike Kuriyama. He's such a, you know, he's got that little soft spoke. You know who he talks like so often is Masami Kuwata. He's got that little that little staccato voice, you know, and he says bump 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 bump, and everything's planned, like he's playing the piano while he's talking, and it's all orchestrated, and then he's going, "Get out of my face, ask him."
Yeah, and
so that was the fighters.
Yeah, I wanted to correct myself. Yeah, because the Marines and fighters played on the weekend or last weekend, so a weekend ago. And so that I thought that was going to get the Marines going, but they didn't do as well as I anticipated them doing against the Buffaloes. But anyway, let's talk about Kuriyama. He, this past week, got victory number 632 as a manager, and he passed. What would you refer to?
Keiji Osawa?
Keiji Osawa, yeah, as the... You know more about the older...
Yeah, Osawa was... he was a manager of the... He managed the fighters a couple of times. He managed... he was one of these guys. Yeah. I'll just say... I'll keep it... You know, keep it really brief. He managed the... He helped build the Hiroshima Carp when they were getting stronger and getting, you know, getting into pennant content, you know, being strong enough to win their first pennant. He managed to turned around the Lotte Orions. He turned around the fighters when he came back for a second time. He did it a lot. And he was fun. He's funny. I mean, he was wild. Anyway, he had 631 wins. And when Kuriyama won his 631st game, it was also the end of a 9-game winless streak for the fighters. And somebody said, "Wow, you won your 630th game." He said, "Get out of my face."
And more "get out of my face" comments.
He said, "It's calm." It said, "It's got nothing to do with anything. Get out of here." And the next day he was sort of calmed down. And, you know, he went through a couple of those. He had a little bit of a, you know, he's 9 straight, you know, games without a win was not a lot of fun for him.
I imagine, and you know, a lot of these teams still don't have all their full complement of foreign players. Many of them are here. Some of them are starting to join. I know that the Bay Stars, who seem to be more affected than any other team in NPB, had Neftali Soto and Tyler Austin join the top team today, but I didn't see if they played or not. It didn't seem to matter because they lost. Again, but yeah, the obviously when the foreign players are available for Kuriyama, the whole dynamics of the team will change. But in the meantime, I still think that he likes the matching and he likes the mixing and he likes doing those things Kuriyama does. So I don't see that derailing his little plan to be the unless he keeps losing and having to say "get out of here" to reporters until he just can't take it anymore. But I think he likes those kinds of things, and I think that's the kind of team he wants to bring out every night. The team that you have to prepare for the entire roster because you don't know who you're going to face.
it's a bit of a Rubik's cube. I don't imagine any of the imports are really going to have much of an impact on the offense because the fighters have basically said our imports are going to be pitchers except for Wang Pojong, who's
I think even with it'll change the pitching dynamics and that it's not going to affect the lineup so much, but yeah.
I think actually that reminds me because I think it was Saturday that they switched out 8 players on the active roster. They sent guys to the farm team. It's like, if you're going to lose, go lose down there.
Yep. And speaking of losing, let's talk about the Central League. And I want to open with the I want to open with the Dragons because they've been losing so much.
That's
the connection. Yeah. Not every team is losing, obviously. Now the Dragons had no home run. They hit a home run in their first game. We brought it up on the show last week. I think Jim asked me who had hit the home run because it was just one, and I said it was Dion Viciado in the opener. And but now there are two. Takuya Kinoshita hit one today and broke the streak. So they had 12 games with no home runs, and that the team hadn't seen that long a stretch in 59 years where it hadn't hit a home run. But I think part of that was because it played in that little bandbox in Nagoya Stadium outside where, you know, you could blow a ball up in the wind and it would go out. But part of it was, and Viciado was deactivated this past week with the very vague explanation of poor condition.
Yep.
So whatever that means. But they weren't coming close to hitting home runs. They did in that first series against Hiroshima. They had some warning track balls, and I thought, oh man, these guys don't have any power. It's all warning track power. And then it just got worse. Even in Nagoya Dome, they weren't even getting into the warning track. So for them to get a home run today was good. But I'm looking at this team as well. And, you know, Kosuke Fukudome, who comes in as the older outfielder replacement guy, they've had to put him in the lineup because they just have not hit. And there was talk about the Giants who hadn't scored more than three runs over a stretch. And then finally today they broke out and scored, was it 9 runs? I think they ended up winning.
They did, 9-0.
9-0. Carp.
They had played, they tied a franchise record with 12 straight. You know, I'm a data guy, but this smacks of the, you know, the winning streak for right-handed pitchers born on October 11th from opening day.
In day games, outdoors on Saturday.
I know. Yeah. Oh, sorry, too much cloud. No, this game started at 3:45. We can't count it as a day game. Okay.
Yeah, well, it was I guess the Dragons had a couple games in there where they had a 5-run game, but they weren't doing much better. So why pick on the Giants? Just because it's a streak. It just really doesn't – I don't see much of a difference. So,
yeah, but 12 games scoring 3 or less. Okay.
Yeah, they've had their problems. Poor Alonzo Powell, he must be, you know, public enemy. I wouldn't say number one, but number something up there with a single digit, because if they're not going to hit, the people are going to look. And I, for the first time, I was watching a broadcast, the broadcast today, and it was the first time that I heard them mention that they had talked to Alonzo about how to approach something. And I know they do that on all the broadcasts, radio and TV. You know, we talked to the pitching coach, and he said he wants him to look for the fastball in this zone and try to take it to the opposite field, blah, blah, blah. But I hadn't heard much of it, but we heard some today. So, but I did notice that Ariel Martinez played on the farm team, and he had a two-hit day the other day and a home run. And honestly, I mean, if he can play first base and they think he's good enough, they might as well bring him up to play first base because they're not getting much power. So that's why, speaking of losing, so they had lost a lot. They only have 5 wins, not that many, and obviously...
Wow.
Well, yeah, whatever. And the Baystars have 3 wins, and the Fighters have 3 wins. So, yeah, the Dragons and Oryx and Lotte all have 5 wins. They all have the same number. So put that in perspective. Can't wait for Interleague.
Oh, man, I'll bet the Central. Well, the Swallows have traditionally done very well. I won't say they've done very well in Interleague, but they've played Pacific League teams better than they've played Central League teams.
Yeah, well, let's hope for the Dragons' sake that Mike Gerber is going to be a productive player and he gets here and he's soon available along with some of the other imports. And I think the other thing to be said, though, about this team is that considering Raydel Martinez,
right,
their closer is not available, I think they're doing well to tread water with all the
Daisuke
who contributed to them.
Daisuke Sobue has been pretty good. Of course, he was pretty good last year as a setup guy. So I think
he was fantastic as a setup guy.
They're going through a few iterations there, but I do love Tsuyoshi Yoda. the manager. In he's so cool and calm, and he's such a he'll say a few harsh things in the media, probably more than I would like, but he's generally very positive. He's got the little bit of that Alex Ramirez vibe. But of course, you can't be a Japanese manager too long if you're too up and positive, because they expect you to say, "We got to knock heads. These guys are losing too much. Get out of my face." Oh, sorry. I didn't mean to go there.
That's interesting, because I like some of the things Shingo Takatsu has been doing as manager, particularly in this series against the Dragons. Like, he brought the infield way up, suicide defense versus the Dragons in the sixth inning of Saturday's game, and it paid off because the Dragons got a hit, but they couldn't get the runner home from second because he had pushed in the outfield in so deep. And I thought part of that was because he was just laughing at the Dragons at the thought of them trying to hit the ball over their outfielders' heads. The other part was that he was bringing in pitchers to face one batter. He was making some moves like it was the playoffs.
Well, he's different to begin with. I mean, he was different as a player. He was the guy who instigated the Rex Hudler earthworm.
Okay.
Story. All right. You got to know that story, right?
Well, we'll talk about it another day. We'll do that another day. So again, somebody remind us. Somebody send in a question about that. And I wanted to mention this because I didn't get a chance to say it last week. There was a poignant moment after the Bay Stars finally won their first game of the season a week ago, and that was when Kosuke Sakaguchi was the winning pitcher, and it was his first as a pro. He's a rookie, I believe. Mm-hmm. And obviously, it was the first for new manager Daisuke Miura. And Miura mashed the ball into the hand of his starting pitcher after the game, giving him the game ball and giving up what was certainly a great memento for a guy who's a much famous personality and figure in the game.
Sure.
And I thought that was a real good message to the team, you know, which was, you know, we're all in this together, and it's you guys, not me. And you guys have to get the job done. It's not about me. Mm. And so I really liked that moment for him. Of course, they didn't win many more games after that, but they won the series in Nagoya against Chunichi, which was good, because I thought, what better for a team that's struggling than a struggling offensive team? And they're hitting. And this kid, Shugo Maki, I believe he was their second pick.
He was.
And they're really going to have to find a place for him. He's a real good contact hitter. We'll get into some other rookies of the year probably maybe next month. Maybe next month. Yeah. You want to do that next month?
We can do that whenever you like.
But he's already ahead of Sato by Teruyaki Sato of the Tigers by miles right now. Sato's going to have to do some catching up. So.
Okay.
All right, making a two-seam transition, there was one low-light play that took place this past week on Tuesday, and what ended up being a 3-3 tie between the Buffaloes and the Marines at Zozo. And that was a fourth inning, and the Buffaloes were down 3-1. And Yuma Tongu took ball four on a 3-2 pitch. He was batting, the Buffaloes were batting, and Stephen Moya, our guest from last week, was the runner on first base. And this comes up because I watch a lot of games at once. And when you do that, you can't watch with the volume on every game. So I often turn the volume off on a couple of games and have one main game and then the volume kind of low on another game. That's how I watch the four games that I'm watching sometimes. And in that particular game, I did not have the volume on, but I've seen this play happen numerous times, and I can't tell what's going on because no one indicates what's going on. And in this situation, you have a runner on first, you have a 3-2 pitch coming, you know the runner is going to automatically be running if they're, you know, even, no matter how many outs there are, but particularly when there are two outs, he's definitely going to be going. There's nothing to lose. Well, this wasn't two outs. I believe it was one out. Mm-hmm. But Stephen Moya was going, and what happens is on a ball, a lot of times the home plate umpire doesn't scream. He's not very demonstrative in making a ball call. And the second base umpire who saw Stephen Moya, who had gone, and he had, you know, the throw was made down by the catcher, and the infielder tagged Steven Moya out, but Moya really didn't know what was going on. So he got up and he stood on second base for a couple of seconds, and then he started to walk away because the umpires rarely, if ever, make a move on that play. They don't make an out call. They don't make a ball call. They do nothing. And so there's a lot of confusion. Now, I don't want to take Steven Moya completely off the hook there because there are a lot of clues. He could have looked at his first base coach. He could have looked at his third base coach. He could have looked at the batter runner who was going to first base. There were a lot of clues and a lot of cues for him, but he didn't look at them. So I don't want to take him off the hook. You've got to look at those things as well. But he didn't know if he was out, safe, if it was ball four, strike three. He had no idea because the umpires don't do anything. And I know that the ball is still live. It's still in play, so that if the catcher, who shouldn't be throwing the ball down to second base, but if he happens to throw it down to second base and it gets past the infielders, then Moya's, you know, obviously he can advance to the next base if he thinks he's capable of running that fast. So the play is not dead per se, but the umpires should say, okay, that's ball four, batter, you're able to advance to the next base. They should do something because I've watched this play numerous times because I see it without the volume on and I don't know what's happening. Mm. I don't even know what's happening.
I'll make it.
So
just...
I would. Oh, yeah, go ahead.
I'll make a comment that, you know, I came to Japan in the 1980s and during the bubble economy, when everything was hyper and everything was crazy, you know, it was like free money everywhere. And all the Japanese banks were like the biggest banks in the world because they were all their assets were based on the value of inflated Tokyo real estate. Anyway, because of that, everybody in Japan had a theory about what made Japanese special. You know, why are we just so great? You know, there was this whole genre of books in Japan about how Japanese are so tremendous. And needless to say, these books just flew off the shelves. If you wrote a story, it said, you know, this and that, it was quality control and it was this and that, and we care about quality. You know, it was so much nonsense. And one of the ones was, it was pretty much everything, every excuse you could think of was trotted out and somebody wrote a book about it. And one of them was Japanese are so good at communicating. But what I find...
I'm not laughing.
what I find is perhaps, but umpires, some of the communication is things people take for granted, you know, nonverbal clues and, you know, the whole... two-layered communication bit. Every language has got it. Japan's not unique, even though everybody in the 80s wrote that Japan was unique. But the whole point is, again, it's sort of like the ball thing. You know, we know what we're doing. So please ignore it when we obviously don't. And the umpires in Japan, I've seen so many games where huge outs were made because the umpires didn't tell anybody what was going on.
Mm, yeah,
you know, the second longest delay in Japan series history was because Atsushi accident waiting to happen. Kisaka was umpiring game one of the 2004 Japan series, and he made an out call but didn't show it. You know, he made it behind his back so nobody could see it. And
out, I think.
Yes, exactly. So nobody assumed that there was an out on the play and that the runner was safe to run to first and there was a force at second. So the fielder, the Lions, Cebu Lions infielder took the ball, stepped on the bag when he had Omar Linares was coming into second base and if the fielder had gone to tag him, he would have been out by 10 feet. But he stepped on the bag, and then Linares slid in, and the umpire said, "You're safe," because the umpire at first ruled the batter out, but didn't tell anybody. So anyway, that precipitated a 40-minute discussion. So that's so – I've seen that happen. I'll have to say I see that happen in Japan about 10 times a year. Where plays happen that shouldn't happen because the umpires don't tell the players what's going on. They don't signal to each other. They don't signal to the players.
And so if you're watching, you don't know what's happening either if you don't have the volume on. Or, you know, some people watch at sports bars, you can't hear what's going on. You've got clues, and the umpire should at least point to the bag and say, you're entitled to this base, and then that's it.
Mm.
But anyway, so yeah, Moya, it was a boneheaded play. And,
on the Sponavi website, on the explanation, the little brief explanation on the pitch by pitch, it said bonehead. I kid you, I'm not kidding.
No, I don't doubt it. Yeah, I don't doubt
it. They call it. So.
All right. And we have one note, and it's from Jim this week. Go ahead, Jim.
Right. As you know, I don't always watch Pro Yaku News, but I do watch it a lot. And I took note about a week ago or 2 weeks ago when Zealous Wheeler was trotted out as the number two hitter for the Yomiuri Giants. And the first thing you'll see, and I love it, I love the guys because sometimes they're so predictable, is when an atypical number two hitter is used in a game, it's the talking heads on Pro Yaku News who feel it's their moral obligation to point out and question this guy's credentials. Is he really, you know, because the number two hitter in Japan, and John and I talked about this at some, and I'm going to be somewhat overgeneralized, but typically the number two hitter is a middle infielder without a lot of offensive pop, usually a guy who runs fast and can hit the ball to the left side of the infield, who can hit behind the runner. You know, they make up all these stories about how the number two hitter has to be so intelligent to be part of the integral. He's sort of like he's the quarterback of the offense, as opposed to the guy who makes so many outs anyway that if he bunts for an out, it doesn't cost us much, which is really what they're doing. So anyway, they had a conversation. Is Zealous Wheeler okay to be batting second? And Dave Okubo said, oh yeah, I managed him at Rakuten, and he is such a smart hitter. He actually cares about, you know, he cares about his teammates. He's just not a big slugger up there to hit and forget about everybody else. He's a smart guy. So, oh, smart. So obviously number two hitters aren't these just bad hitters that we're told we can put there, but they have to have superpowers. And
the dumber you are, the lower in the lineup.
Yeah, pretty much, whatever. But the whole point is, if you don't fit the image, you know, I swear you could be dumb as a post, but if you're 5 feet tall and a second baseman and quick and a left-handed hitter, nobody would ever ask
once in your life. Yeah.
Yeah. Nobody would ever ask if you were qualified to bat second. You know, you wouldn't even ever have to bunt. They would just look at you and say, yeah, that's our guy. That's our Japanese number two hitter. But if it's Zealous Wheeler, or if it's this past week when Norichika Aoki was went into quarantine for coronavirus, they had to find a number two hitter. So they dropped their catcher, Yuhei Nakamura, in the number two spot, which is surprisingly not that unusual, but he's not a very fast guy. And again, this conversation started all over again. But it was the other one. Not is he not, you know, is he Japanese enough to bat second, but is he too good to bat second? Isn't he too good of a hitter? Which I love, because they have to tell you that the number two hitter's got like these superpowers that do not go noticed in the batting line. You know, that's how they can hide somebody who's completely and utterly useless there by saying, oh yeah, bat control.
Well, you know, I loved the idea of Zealous Wheeler in the number two hole, and not just because they played the Dragons early on and he just has in his career, I just have this image of him as a Dragons killer. And he's hit so well against them in my mind. And they've only really played in interleague, but I just remember him doing damage. And, you know, not always with home runs, but just key hits or clutch hits and just coming up big for them. So, and I just like, because he can do so many things, he can hit the other way, he can hit for power, he can, and he he gets on base. You know, he just does everything. He just doesn't have the figure, if you will, for a number two hitter. He's not small. He's not speedy. But he just does everything that you would want for a number two hitter. So I didn't see a problem in it. And plus, you know, putting him anywhere around Sakamoto would make your lineup just have a lot more punch and add a lot more depth. So I just like the whole notion. So it's just too bad that he had ended up getting deactivated with this Corona isolation situation that's going on with the Giants.
The Giants bat to Hayato Sakamoto a lot, bat him second a lot. Nobody questions it because he's technically capable of, and he'll lay down a sacrifice bunt about once or twice a year.
Mm-hmm.
And he's technically capable of it, so nobody questions it. Oh, and he's a shortstop, you know. Oh no, he's not, but he's really atypical. But nobody questions it, right, because he's got some speed, and oh, and he's the team captain, and he's, you know, going to play for the team, you know, whatever, you know, whatever excuses you want to trot out for doing for forget it. I've had it.
Yeah. All right. Well, I know what you're saying, and let's just keep an eye on some of the number twos as we go through the season and see what some of the other managers do. All right.
Mm-hmm.
All right. Let's go to fielding questions.
Hashtag high heat.
All right. So this question comes from Ian. It's via email, and Ian's in Houston. And he said, obviously, he sent this question a little while back, maybe a couple weeks. Do you think Teruaki Sato will be able to translate any of his performance during the spring into the regular season? Where would you start him on defense? He looks like a great addition to the team so far. Your thoughts. Listening weekly from Houston, Ian. All right. So Sato obviously had a power-filled and fun-filled preseason. That was easy to see. But he also hit 375, and that was important to me because I saw different swings in various situations. But none of this had anything to do with game situation or regular season situation. So I know maybe for Jim it's not a big deal, but it's more than homers for me. I want to see you do the other things too. When you get two strikes on you, how do you change your swing? How do you change your approach? How do you try to get on base and keep the inning going or just not make an out? And I saw so many former players on TV just drooling all over this kid. And I was too. I was throwing in my towel and saying, hey, I got a puddle of drool around me too.
Way too much information.
I wouldn't say he was, you know, he was must see TV, but he was certainly I want to see TV. And I was trying to catch all of his at-bats during the preseason and the first week of the season. I'm like, ooh, when Sato's, you know, coming up in the lineup, I got to make sure I'm watching the Tigers game. And I like his patience. I like his balance. He just seems to take really comfortable swings. He's not, like, reaching a lot of times. He's making pretty good contact. And he'd been driving the ball the other way in the preseason. The pitchers were pitching him away, and they wanted to diminish his power by doing that, but he was hitting the ball out to left field, and I'm like, geez, where do you pitch this guy? And so now we've seen guys make adjustments, and as I said before, all the teams have seen him now, so I think I expect the teams to make more adjustments as they go through. He's going to have to prove himself the whole season, so I'm excited. He hit that ball. Last time I saw a ball go out there at Yokohama Stadium was when Dave Nielsen hit one out for the Dragons out on the, you know, in the dirt patch that was out there. I don't know what's out there now because I haven't been to Yokohama yet this year. But so the kid has a lot of power. There's just no doubt about it. And he's fun to watch. And even Shintaro Fujinami said in his hero interview after he won the game, he said, everybody on the bench was shocked that, you know, we'd never seen a ball go out like that far. So he's fun. He's promising, but he's not, as we talked about earlier, he is not right now the front runner for Rookie of the Year. It's definitely Shugo Maki of the Bay Stars. Jim, what do you have to say about it?
Well, yeah, we've seen him go through some iterations, and people have pointed out, okay, he's going to have to learn how to do this. He's going to have to learn a lot of things because now everybody's seen him and people are going to start adjusting to him. And people who've been playing professional baseball are probably going to make those adjustments faster than he is. So I expect him to go through a little bit of a down slope, but you know, as they, you know, they identify certain weaknesses of his, and he identifies, you know, how people are playing him. But I'll tell you one thing, one of his weaknesses is not straight fastballs down the middle.
Right.
That's what we saw. There's nothing wrong with being able to hit fat pitches. I mean, that's a key part. You know, that's like having a shortstop. You know, that's your middle infielders make the routine plays, hit, you know, be ready to crush, you know, good pitches, or to do what you need to do with good pitches. And he's got that part down. So that's, you know, that's part of the part of the learning process. And so he's going to learn how to more and more how to get those fat pitches as he goes along, and, you know, and he learns the game, because these guys have been playing it along a lot longer than he has, and they've got more experience at it, and he's going to face vastly better pitchers than he's ever seen in his life. And he's going to be like, you know, my favorite one was Shohei Ohtani when he was 18 years old, and his first at bat was against Takayuki Kishi. And he struck out and he went, oh my goodness me. like where did that come from?
Yeah. I'm gonna have to do my homework.
Exactly. He was like, wow. I was like, he said, you know, kind of in awe, and he felt like, I'm honored to be in, you know, be able to stand in the batter's box. Of course, they doubled off him later in the game. So, you know, he got over it. But he only hit, you know, 235 or something as a rookie. So it's an effort. And it's a process, as John is fond of saying. And I'm excited to see it. And I don't even want to think of who the possible rookies of the year are. But it is interesting that there are so many rookies to talk about. I mean, there, of course, it's April, so there's a lot of rookies to talk about, because they haven't had chances to visibly fail yet.
Yeah, we'll see some fall off a little bit.
Yeah, exactly. I think by August, you'll have probably, you know, two pitchers who look pretty good and a couple of hitters who've got, you know, 150 plate appearances, and one of them's, you know, maybe two regulars, and one of them's good and one of them's less good.
Yeah, I would even say Ryoji Kuribayashi of the Carb comes right now before Sato.
I would too. I would,
because
too.
He's perfect in his save opportunities, I believe. So, but I would say this about the, you asked what position, Ian, you asked what position I would have Sato playing. And I know they're working him out at first base, and they've got him in the outfield. I would say wherever you need him.
Yeah, leave him in the outfield for now. I mean,
yeah, no, but I mean, you know, when all, yeah, when everybody comes back and you have your full complement of foreign players, I think he looks good in right field for me at the moment. I mean, even the best right fielders or the best outfielders can have a bad moment. And, we saw that today in the Oryx game. I don't know if you saw that, but Taishi Ota is a really good outfielder, but he looked pretty bad on a ball that just,
yeah, he misjudged,
just kind of
that.
Fooled him. Those things can happen. So I'm not going to judge Sato on a couple plays here and there missing the cutoff man today and letting a runner move up an extra base or advance to the next base. I won't blame him for that, but he's not great, but he's not awful. But I just think he's young. So I would just put him in the outfield, but wherever I need him, you know, if it's left one day, left, if it's right, right. And if it's at first base, put him there.
Yeah. I mean, he's
going to make mistakes.
I mean, as a player, you know, his build, he reminds me of a young Tomoki Kanemoto, but except he's 4 years younger than Kanemoto was when he was Kanemoto, you know.
Yeah,
he's way ahead of that progress.
Yeah. Yeah, I think I mentioned that. That was my comp for him. Yeah, is Kanemoto. Hopefully he can turn into something similar to that or just like that. Yeah,
actually, that'd be great for Hunchy. You know, talking about young players, and maybe you noticed this is a complete 100% digression, but I was watching Yosuke Tatsumi of the Eagles, and I can't.
Oh, so good.
And I can't shake this. You know, sometimes when you get an analogy in your head, it just sticks with you, and you're trying to get rid of it and trying to find out why you even think so. But when I see him swing, I see a left-handed hitting Tetsuya Yamada.
Ah, I don't see that. So,
he doesn't have the really loose. He doesn't have that loosey-goosey willow whippy swing, but he's
and got he doesn't have the leg movements.
He doesn't have that. But the swing itself, just like it looks like the barrel's coming at you so fast that it's like a cartoon.
All right. Well, I don't see it, but I'll look for it the next time I
see it. No, I see it in the swing. Yeah, I don't see it in the mechanics, but
yeah, he's so good. He's so good. You remember, I think we talked about the Eagles having all these, they were collecting all these outfielders who were pretty good.
Well, they settled on him.
Give a couple away. Yeah. Oh yeah. Yeah, for sure. All right. Well, we'll wrap it up here. We have some other questions on deck, but we'll hold them for next time. And
wait your Jim, turn.
Jim, you have an event coming up.
I do. Today, Monday, 11 a.m., subscribers, free or paid, to jbullellen.com can chat with Kent Blasingame. He's a professional scout for the Fukuoka SoftBank Hawks and son of a real Japanese baseball legend, Don Blasingame.
Okay. Yeah, that sounds like fun. I hope people listen early, and I'll try to get this up as soon as possible so they have time to scatter around and prepare. But it sounds like fun. Sounds like fun. All right. Anyone else who has a question, hit us up on Twitter at JBW Podcast with the hashtag High Heat. Send questions via email to yakyujohn@gmail.com or hit us up on the Facebook page. We will talk to you next week. Enjoy your baseball.
See you at the ballpark.
Follow the hosts on Twitter at JBW Podcast and at JBallAllen. And feel free to submit your questions by email or tweet with hashtag High Heat. Thank you for listening to Japan Baseball Weekly.